The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Doug warps our minds with his pitch. Roger turns to liquid, itty. Menz makes his mark on the bits, no guarantees. More fraud, spies, and lies. And even I don't know what else. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
We have Doug Simmons from, is it Cognitive Defense, Doug?
Yes, that's the name of the company, Fred. Thank you.
There you go. So introduce yourself and your company and tell us what you do.
Well, thank you, Fred, and thanks for the opportunity. My name is Doug Simmons, and I'm the CEO of the new company called Cognitive Defense that really is focusing on countering influence operations.
When you say countering influence operations, I don't think everybody understands what people mean when they say influence operations. Can you just tell us what is an influence operation?
Yeah, an influence operation is largely something, I'm going to say, it's multifaceted. But the simplest cases for people to gain an understanding about this is some party or parties from outside an organization trying to get at sensitive information within the company you work for. Things like trade secrets, intellectual property, the things that goes into the widgets that you make that, you know, makes your company.
You're talking about like the Coca-Cola thing where an insider was selling secrets and the Coke.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. From an influence standpoint, we've used the phrase in cybersecurity over the past 20 years around social engineering. In my mind, you know, it might not be correct, but in my mind, it's a social engineering on steroids, kind of an operation, influence operation.
So when you say social engineering, so the classic social engineering stuff was where you, one of the great ones is you call up and say, computer support.
Yeah.
And they say, oh, computer support. Yeah, there was a problem on your computer.
Yep.
And we need to fix it. If you can share your screen, you know, we'll be able to help fix the problem. And it's sort of an urgent matter because we have a computer virus spreading.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that you're properly configured. Yeah, that's right. Please share. Yeah. Go to this URL. Okay. And then you continue on the call. And eventually they give you your password. They may give you access to files, you know, whatever you want them to do. And that's the cyber version of what before that was the same thing when you walk in physically wearing what looks like a computer repair person shirt, say, I'm from corporate computer repair and we got some problems. We have to update your internet or update your Ethernet or, you know, we have a screen update, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And now you open up the computer and take out the disk and say, oh man, this is a problem. I think it's not going to be fixed till tomorrow. So let me give you a receipt and I'll come back.
Yeah, you got it. It's gone, let me be the first one to tell you, Fred, that's a good way to characterize the problem, and it still is a big problem. However, we're in uncharted territory now with multi-mode, especially things like social media, with the large language model and generative AI capabilities that fraudsters have. And fraudsters can be a very wide kind of a way of describing people that may be nation states. Like you mentioned the Coca-Cola incident. That was largely being driven out of the People's Republic of China in terms of trying to get intellectual property to manufacture their own liner for way less than they would have had to pay otherwise, right? And this is an age-old problem. But when you bring social media and when you bring mobile phones and when you bring the ability of these bad actors to scan people's – I'll just use social media as the catch-all because it's kind of a nefarious environment – to scan folks' social media postings, whether it's on LinkedIn, Facebook, what have you, sees what they're posting on Twitter X or whatever. And the bad actors can start to learn. And they can use AI to help, weed through this too much quicker than they were able to before. what your nuances are, what a person's capabilities, nuances, what access they have, what their predisposition are, maybe politically or societally or climate change wise, whatever it may be, they can find ways to hit hot buttons on people to get them to like the malicious actor and eventually start to, you know, work with this actor, not knowing, of course, that they're a malicious actor, but thinking they're one of them, you know, they're on their side and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So there's also really stuff like job scams where they're offered to, yeah, you know, an opportunity to get a job and they provide all their information to the potential future employer, their social security number, of course, absolutely, and everything else. Yeah. And yeah, then, of course, it's just a scam. And, all, well, and there's lots
could possibly
of these
go wrong, right?
Yeah, right. What could, yeah, possibly? So there's that, the ability to leverage the new technology. Then there's also these deep fakes, right? So where, yes, the boss calls you up and says, you know, you have to really open an account and transfer this money right away. Yeah. And it's in the boss's voice, right?
Yep, that's correct. That's, yeah, correct. And, you know, it seems like, well, I was just reading about one, I can't remember the company, but this just happened a few days ago. And it's actually going back to the IT example you have. But the fact of the matter is that the bad actors are able to generate deceptive counterfeit voicemails. So it's not just text-based email, but they're able to use multimode to get at people and make them or help them believe that they're really talking to the real person when it's a deep fake and they are.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about, and there's obviously lots of problems in the world, but you know, what are the solutions here? Right. So I don't think we're going to be able to make people so that they are not subject to, oh, you know, another one is the having a call from your grandson that says I'm in jail and I have, yes, to get out of here, that there are these big men looking to rape me or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. Can you get me out of jail, grandpa? You know, I, yeah, couldn't get in touch with, and you know, if you're a grandfather awakened at, you know, 12:30 or, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning with your grandson in their voice calling,
yep,
and saying that they need this thing and they're in jail, they can only stay on for another 30 seconds. I'm going to send you a text that, you know, gives you instructions. You're going to fall for that, right? I mean, it's hard to not, you know, what's more important, a couple $1,000 or the well-being of your grandchild?
Yeah, well, listen, I don't want to fall into the trap that, I don't know what I would do in that particular case, but let's put it this way. When we're talking about countering influence operations, it's trying to maybe raise the tide for all people in society to improve critical thinking. And I know that is a very, you know, loaded term. There's a lot that goes into it. Critical thinking is something that requires maybe more neural pathways to be operational than we're used to today, where we're actually being proactive in terms of thinking through how this particular case, my pseudo grandson calling me in the middle of the night, first thing that should come to my mind or anyone's mind is that this is probably fraud. Are there any things that I can detect through what's going on at this point in time that would say, yeah, that's a fraud? Are there some things that I could do that would delay my having to wire the money so that in case it really is my grandson, that I'm not leaving him hanging? But it's, you know, I don't have the exact solution to what you mentioned, but there's definitely some critical thinking that needs to be front and center in people's minds when anybody contacts them and asks for something, I'll just say, out of the blue and tries to take advantage of your, I'll just say, weakness or your emotion or whatever it may be at that point in time. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. You know? Go ahead.
Let's talk about the corporate issue here, right? So yeah, you're not selling this to individuals. You're selling it to companies, as I understand.
Right. It's the companies that have the Coca-Cola, that has the special, you know, BMW carburetor, that has, or fuel injection system for Ferrari. It's those kinds of things that people want to steal and re-engineer on their own. Those are the big ones. And then there's also in other industries, you know, financial, customer financial information, healthcare information, those things that are worth a lot of money to bad actors.
So my question surrounds, what do you do for that company, right? I mean, obviously, right, you know, you can't sell the company that we're going to, you know, touchy-feely cause all of your workers to all of a sudden be brilliant at countering these things, but they'll never be perfect. How do you solve the company's problem,
yeah,
not just the problem of an individual?
Well, it's really around training. And, you know, We'll call this something that's focused on influence operations and cognitive development training and the cybersecurity awareness training umbrella. We want to focus on helping the organization. I'll just say an individual organization. What we do from our approach standpoint is first understand how the organization is structured, what makes it work, who the important people are, who have access to, what types of sensitive information. We get a lay of the land from their cybersecurity architecture standpoint in terms of where sensitive data may be, what the access control mechanisms are in place, and the approvals and the workflows that may go along with granting it, blah, blah, blah. We capture that right up front to learn what the organization is like and who does what. Then we bring to the organization a gamified experience. And this is where I think there's some key differentiation. Our research has shown that from a human risk management standpoint, that people are mostly not at all engaged in listening to cybersecurity training and saying, thou shalt do this, you really shouldn't do that. And maybe some of the things I was even espousing 5 minutes ago. However, to rewire neural pathways, we found that gamification is a good way to get people to, number one, have fun doing something. Number two, be competitive in trying to be better than their co-workers, I'll say, or the other game participants.
All right, but you keep talking about training, and we know that training is limited, right? The best available training today maybe gets 80% effective against stopping people from clicking on links and emails, and that's just emails. Doesn't even address the multimodal issues.
Right.
So besides training, you can train like mad forever and you'll never get perfect people. What else do you do to help the enterprise?
So, the important aspect is there's really three legs to the stool. The first one is going in and capturing the current state, how the organization operates, the things I described 5 minutes ago. The second thing we do is bring the game to the table and encourage participants, especially the ones that have access to sensitive information, to regularly play the game, and we take information from how these people are doing to help the third leg of the stool. The third leg of the stool is a reasonable and prudent future state for the organization with respect to cybersecurity in general and information protection and influence operation combating in particular. So what we do on a regular basis, on a monthly basis rather, it's not just we go in, we take your money, here's the game, have fun, but we continue to look at how the organization is structured, how this cybersecurity architecture is established, what tools are in place, what people, process, and technology, not just tools and technology, are in place, where the strengths are, where the weaknesses are. Based on the game findings, what could be better? And when you talk about the 80-20%, okay, so 20% might not be salvageable or solvable by an improved cognitive state of the organization, but that 20% then would be where we would focus more on the process and technology to help shore that up. So that
all right, just to get a sense of this, right? Yeah. So what I think you're saying here is we maybe can train you to be less susceptible to some sorts of influence operations, but at the end of the day, if we know what you're susceptible to, we can put technical countermeasures in place to mitigate the resulting, I guess they call it the residual risk.
That's right.
Right. Then the other thing is maybe those processes also trigger some of the cognitive responses.
By adding
that additional authentication, we can remind them that, aha, this is one of those things you probably shouldn't be doing unless you're really doing it for the right reasons.
That's right.
And so this fusion of the technical architecture and the things you do technically and the processes you put in place, and then the people and their training allows, they'd call it a synergistic effect. Is that right?
That's really it, Fred. If I may.
But I'm not sure that you can.
I've been working in the cybersecurity space for going on 30 years now. A lot of it is focused on the technology, the architecture, the segmentation of the network, the access controls, the firewalls, the protocols, all those things. Wonderful. They work, to the best of their degree in most cases. What hasn't been happening is a lot of investment in what I'll call human risk management. That's the whole cognitive side. And that's really an in-depth area that needs a lot more attention. Attention is a big word. It's not just, let's just throw some tools at helping human risk management, but it's an understanding of how cognition works and how people can rewire their brains to think in, and this probably sounds Orwellian, but to think in different ways We're just trying to help people improve their critical thinking in that regard. So the human risk management piece of the overall cybersecurity posture is on par, right? The human risk management, we don't want to be something.
Let me ask you this. You keep talking about risk management. Isn't there another benefit to the enterprise of having people that are, better at thinking about things?
I should hope so, because I think they'll make better risk management decisions across the board. It's not just about
managing risk. It's about, doing a better job, right?
If you're thinking about what you're doing and paying attention.
Yeah.
And I'll just say one more thing, and maybe I shouldn't add this, but I'm hoping that they'll even be able to take this home with them and apply improved critical thinking skills in their home life and in their social life.
Well, yeah, well, but I mean, for example, maybe not taking ridiculous risks. So, teenagers, it's wired into their brain to take bigger risks. But when you're working at the company, maybe it's not the best idea to go jumping out of airplanes, when you haven't given anybody else the keys that allow them to, fix the infrastructure if it breaks. Mm-hmm. Right?
Correct.
So, just teach them enough to have somebody else that knows how to do it in case when they jump out of that airplane without a parachute, they land in somewhere hard instead of somewhere soft.
I think, we've said it for decades now, right? Get hit by that proverbial bus. What happens then, right?
Yeah. Well, and the enterprise cares, but maybe you shouldn't. If I get hit by a bus, I don't think I will care anymore. Yep. But if you have good health insurance, maybe you should. Doug, it's great to talk to you. We don't have forever to do this, so they can look at your GWiz by going to cybershow.co and see more information on the company, and they can get in touch with you there as well, right?
Yes. And Fred, I'd love to participate in the future if you'd like to have me. Thank you very much.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Just pull a double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their GWiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. This week marks the beginning of Cybersecurity Awareness Month, a month when we try to make the world more aware of cybersecurity issues. So I expect to get twice as many cybersecurity ads this month in my emails. Well, I guess that will make me more aware of spam, at least. And that's breaking news on the Cyber Show. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the 5 ways we know today. 1, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show, only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Every once in a while, you come across a fraud that you can't resist putting on The Cyber Show. Here's one such fraud. Dear Fred Cohen, oh, thank you. That's the subject of the email from Steve Bradner, UN. Oh, how official sounding. So it's from Steve Bradner, UN, email address stevebradnerun@gmail.com to whatever my email address is that they're using. Reply to stevebradnerun@diplomats.com. Because diplomats use .com addresses, right, as a group. Dear Fred Cohen, your draft has been pending for months, and you have refused to secure your delivery of $1,350. Should we now send this draft back to the United Nations Treasury as unclaimed funds by you? Thanks for your cooperation. Regards, Steve Bradner, Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer of the United Nations. Okay, guys.
Give me a break. Huh. Meanwhile, it has the previous email where whenever somebody sent me whatever the original spam was, I said, please send your certified check to P.O. Box 811, Pebble Beach, California, 93953, which is my post office box. Because I figure if you're going to send me a check, if you want to pay me something, just send me a certified check and I'll be happy to process it. Well, it took a while to get back, but that was in July, and now we're, you know, into September, so it took them a month to get back. But I just thought I would update you, and as this fraud attempt continues, I will continue to update you on the United Nations chief financial officer, who has a gmail.com address for official processes and uses diplomats.com as their email. One of the newest frauds on the internet today is a multi-step process. It starts with an initial contact offering something you want or need for your job. Then as you start to communicate, you get a link or a file emailed to you, chatted to you, texted to you, or connected to you through a social media application. When you open this file or click on the link, it displays a message indicating that it was corrupted and could not be opened. But in reality, it contains malicious code that merely displays that message and leaves a Trojan horse on your computer. Once that Trojan horse is in place, the attacker is in your system and expands their access to perform any of a number of malicious acts, typically ranging from extortion, this is often in the form of ransomware, to financial theft, for example, by altering banking information on an invoice. What can you do about it? Well, there's nothing much you can really do to prevent this sort of deception from working. The reason is that if you don't use the internet to get in touch with people in order to get your job done, you're likely not to be able to get the job done. But when you encounter the situation, you can recognize this scenario. And if you do, you can immediately contact whoever's in charge of cybersecurity and have them fix the problem before it gets worse. In the meanwhile, try and be safe out there, but don't imagine you're going to be perfect against modern threats.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, ELN, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence, and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel to exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events and help host online forums, panels, and events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. For more details, become a member at enterprisemindset.com.
ELN will have a forum at the Monterey Plaza Hotel on November 13th and 14th of this year. To sign up, go to thecybershow.co and click on the link to ELN. This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. Mark Menz was one of the early folks in digital forensics, working for law enforcement and for the public well-being, as well as on many private cases. Early in my forensics career, I encountered Mark, and I thought you'd be interested in some of the things that we've done throughout the course of our lives and some of the discussions we've had. Here's Mark.
So, Mark Menz, welcome to the Cyber Show. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you for having me on.
So, Mark, you know, the reason normally that, you know, we have folks on the show is because they know all sorts of stuff about the history of cyber. And in your case, my knowledge of your early history in the space is limited, but I do know you've done a lot in the digital forensics arena. So I want to start at the beginning of your career, like not when you were born, but soon after that. Where did you go to school? What did you get a degree in, if anything? And how did you end up doing whatever you do?
Well, I originally was born in Los Angeles and grew up down in the Toluca Lake area, right behind Universal Studios. And then we moved to Sacramento. Best thing my father and mother ever did. Wound up going to Rio Americana High School. Then I did some time at Sac State, Cal State University, Sacramento.
But I love the way you talk about this stuff, right? So just to be clear, you know, it's hot as blank in Sacramento as opposed to LA, which I guess is cold by comparison. But you did time. You know, usually people are talking about being in jail and you're talking about being in college, which might have been the same thing to you. But I just want to make sure that they know that that's actually a college. It's not a jail.
When I started over there, they had a cyber system, and I got slightly famous for a couple of incidences that occurred. One was on the computer. One was the system of the computer. And a third one was a boat that was left in the fountains in front of the library.
All right. So let's start with the first story. You called them cyber systems. Did you call them that then, or is that a newer word you're using now?
Well, it was actually the cyber. That was the name of the system, cyber system.
It's called cyber system.
Okay. That was a mainframe that they had. What I had done, getting classes. I got to back up from that. In high school, we got interested in computers. And we're kind of interested.
When you say we... I presume that you're talking about somebody very close to you. Why don't you reveal the secret of your relationship?
So I have an identical twin brother, and both of us identical. We looked alike. People couldn't tell us apart. And even though we have some differences in what we do, somehow we are both involved in the field of cyber and cybercrime. So we wound up there separately.
Just for clarity, you're not both involved in cybercrime. You're both involved in defending against and countering cybercrime, right?
Correct.
Or at least that's what you tell everybody.
Yeah, that's what we tell everybody. But yes, that's what we do. We defend against it.
All right. So back in high school.
So I got back in high school. I had a friend whose father worked for IBM, and allowed us access to an IBM 680.
Okay. And now, what is a 680 for everybody that doesn't know?
IBM 680 is a mainframe, and in this particular case, it also had not only the standard Fortran language on it, but it also had APL,
programming language. Yeah, yeah.
And we used IBM Selectric Teletype typewriter that was a terminal, so everything was printed out on paper. We learned a lot about. Yeah, there we go. There's a keyboard like they used to be.
Yeah, I got one. In fact, this is even an APL keyboard. It has the APL keyboard.
And then,
oh, you have one too. Yeah. I love it. Okay.
So that is scary, Fred. So I learned APL, and I really had a lot of fun on the computer, and we kind of stuck with it. And then Tandy, we bought a MSI. 8080.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and then we got a TRS-80, which was a great little machine for the price. And
did you have the audio tape that was used to store the data?
We had the audio tape that was used to store data and also programs. In fact, I still have that original machine.
Does it still work?
It still works.
Just in case we have a forensics case, anybody out there, if you have a forensics case involving a TRS-80, Mark has a working version, so we could actually reconstruct the whole thing.
Well, and technically, my brother and I over the years have acquired and also kept everything we've ever had. So we have a large collection of drives and machines for all kinds of computers. So we have people come to us all the time when they're doing forensics on our old system. We have equipment that can read it and a lot of times just in play it, you know, K-Pro.
Not just the hardware, but you need the software to read it too, because, you know, even with the hardware, you might not know the mechanisms they use to do it.
Correct. And we've tried to transfer a lot of the software over to other media, because this professor I knew who used to be at USC and kind of coined the term virus for everybody, did a case where he could explain when the floppy disk would lose their magnetism. And
so you actually read that?
Actually read that.
Okay, so you and like three other people ever read that paper. I love it.
Correct.
It was an interesting case, right? Because the bits had flipped, and we figured out the only possibilities for the way they could have flipped. So that was pretty interesting.
No, isn't this fun? You know, I love our community so bloody much, right? You know, shout out to Greg Woods. I haven't seen Greg in decades, but, you know, of early Unix guru, the Usenix crowd up in Toronto, with his PDP 11s running the basement and so forth. You know, the legacy of technology that's at home with folks in our crowd is kind of amazing.
Well, you know, I just, why is it that this story sounds so familiar?
Right?
It's like, well, I started out when I was young and, you know, and I sort of almost got in trouble for a couple of things that I did. And, but, you know, I managed to not go to jail. So that's the hacker in this all, but you'll find out. But this hoarding is fascinating. So, you know, I was in a case once where we needed some model of some computer from 15 years before, you know, 20 years before. It was a patent case, right? And they needed to, you know, demonstrate that a system that existed at that time with the same software and the same hardware would, in fact, do the same thing. So it's actually, patent cases are generally 20 years, right? So this was an old computer, and we had to find one. So it turns out there's a guy that collects old computers. He buys them from swap meets. People, you know, give them to him. They throw them away. Went into his garage, a rented garage space, you know, the room for basically one standard container. And you go in there, and the thing is just jam-packed from floor to ceiling with just piles of computer parts. I mean, piles and piles from different eras and ages. And went in there and found several computers that were of the right type, of the right age, found, you know, disk drives, found display money, found all the parts you needed to get one from the date. And then, because you have to look inside the computers, you have to open them up and date all the chips and everything to verify that it hasn't been updated since then to get back to really original parts. So there are these people that have these things, and they're generally called hoarders. And you see these movies about hoarders and the people that have the TV shows where they have stuff in their house. You can't walk through the house. Well, you know, Mark's more organized than that. But between Mark and Mike, they have this vast collection of still working old stuff of every sort.
I'd like to produce this show rather than star in anything. So I'll say this out there. If you want to make an American Cyber Pickers show, I'll produce that. That could be fun. Right.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, there are folks out here. There's, you know, I'm surprised that neither of us can pull it up in my head. Todd Kleinert in Utah is the closest I can come. But I know he's not doing this sort of thing. But, you know, who are tracking them down. Right. You know, and flying around and going across the country and around the world to get some piece of hardware from some other, you know, cyber collector. Right. And it's a fascinating thing, right? You know, and Todd, I met in Utah in 96 when I moved there, and he was working at a used computer store, right? And I was building my home network, and I got my neighbor next door talked into it. We had a big yard. We put a big racetrack out there for RC cars and put, you know, internet, you know, and yeah, you know, old computers running Unix and cameras and things and so forth, right? It's there's this legacy, you know, one of the things I think is interesting about the modern world is we live in a world of post-production, right? You know, there are collectors. I remember meeting this guy who was a bit of a hoarder, but very organized, lived in a small place. We had this huge collection of California raisins, and we're talking about it. And 300 years ago, you couldn't be a collector. There weren't things to collect, right? You know, now we live in this world where there is, for example, here, there's been billions of tons of technology created in the last century. A lot of it's still hanging around, right? You can just find things that already exist and bolt them together and make almost anything.
So there's a couple of really interesting things about that, but the reconstruction for digital forensics is what, you know, Mark and Mike deal with. You know, so you need to establish the provenance of these things to demonstrate they're of the proper age. And then you need to actually apply them to demonstrate or to test or to find what you're looking for. So this is tricky business. And there's also in Silicon Valley, there's the Computer History Museum.
Right.
And the Computer History Museum has a substantial collection, but they won't take just anything. So there are people that are in the specific business of dealing with legal issues, forensics for cases, and providing you with, you know, the authentic hardware from that date. And you know, these things get old and dust and other things gets to them. So they end up, they have to seal them in various ways. The discs degrade. There's all sorts of stuff that, that goes wrong in these older systems. And the other thing is, you know, what is it about, you know, those people in that time frame that decided to start collecting this, you know, in 1970, whatever, right? Or 60, whatever. You know, and so they somehow made that decision then. And you know, lots of people had old stuff. I had old stuff, but I got married and my wife said, no, you can't, that's not going to happen. But I was, you know, I had this stuff in the garage and we moved again. Eventually I tossed almost all of that. But thank goodness there are people that still have it.
So I still have my Apple IIc in the denim bag. You know, I don't have the Sinclair 1000, you know, which was my first, you know, computer that I had of my own, but,
Sorry, I don't have my mechanical computer, which is from way, way back, but I do have my my little what is it, an HP, you know, 45 LC or whatever, 95 whatever. It's a little teeny HP with the little keyboard you can push on, and it still works. But I got to tell you, that was better than any of the input mechanisms I've seen since. And I wish I could get that same form factor for the modern everything.
To the point of our guest here today, right? You know, digital forensics, and you know, as we're riffing on here, you know, the history aspect of it, I've enjoyed all along. I appreciate history, and I hold these things in my hand and think out, you know, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years from now, this thing's going to be, you know, now it's just dime a dozen junk, you know, but at some point it's going to be, oh my God, yeah, at that point, right? You appreciate the time you're in. And in February 2019, I was in Guyana with Tim Roxy and Vic Heider. And we had to get a suitcase to bring a server back, you know, to the States, you know, for digital forensics and tear down the chips and the whole fancy stuff. So we're standing, you know, the two of them are, you know, getting from a street vendor a suitcase, and Tim had gotten some bloody song stuck in my head, you know, so I'm, you know, standing in the street, you know, in Georgetown, bopping along to some song while my friends are getting a suitcase to get this computer. That at the time was a standard server, you know, standard, you know, just run of the mill sort of thing, you know, and don't get me started on Guyana, but, you know, Guyana's, you know, ran into a lot of oil wealth and so forth, got hacked, and, you know, dealing with their infrastructure going forward is a fascinating thing. But this individual machine is nothing, right? Then it's already kind of interesting because it wasn't new then. Now it's 4 years later, and in 10 years and 20 years and 50 years, right? That standard, right? You know, picture of a server you'd find in a computer room in a second world country at a time like, you know, a couple of years ago, it's going to be fascinating to somebody, right? And it's, you know, surfing the security side of this, right? Being able to not only appreciate the history of all this as it's happening, but look at it, those methods. Like everything you said, you know, and Mark giving the background of the story and what I know about these things, like, you know, standing there with Vic and Tim is like, okay, this thing's going back, you know, to a resource facility in the States where it's going to be taken apart, you know, medieval, right? Debride the chips. We're going to go all the way down into this thing. And just, I don't know, every level of it. It just fascinates me no end.
We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co. Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Roger Royce is one of the most well-known and well-positioned attorneys working on cyber issues, particularly in the ag tech arena, but also in many other areas. He also has a tremendous understanding of influence and related issues, as we'll see in our discussions.
The SEC has declared war. Let's just be, I'm not supposed to talk politics, but let's just say it's a harsh regulatory environment for crypto.
Well, right, it's now. Not politics to talk about the reality of regulations. You're a lawyer, there are regulations, and that's how the world is, right? Yeah. As long as you don't say you're for it or against it, I guess it's not politics to talk about, you know, regulation. It exists.
What's happened? All of those companies have gone offshore, you know, that look, we can do our deals in other countries. We don't have to put up with this. And that's chasing.
Which I think is good, right? They've sent their scams elsewhere because a large portion of these are scams. If you look at the cryptocurrency world, right, it was born out of trying to get around legal restrictions on transfers of money, get around taxes, try and create confidentiality, trying to mimic what cash does in some way, but for larger volumes. And it's been exploited, in the first 5 or 10 years of the cryptocurrency world, maybe 70-80% of all the transactions were criminal. And then it moved into the big scam arena, people taking tens and twenties of billions of dollars, and it just disappears. And those people are now getting arrested, and the market, it's not tied to any fiat currency or any other thing of value. So it's just completely speculative, right? It's all based on, the perceived value of a bunch of bits and a concept.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there were a lot of utility. This started with utility tokens. And these were people just trying to monetize a legitimate utility.
It's actual ownership in something real that you're buying and selling, and this is just another way to buy and sell it, why aren't you just selling and buying the actual stock?
Oh, because it just makes it easier. Like real estate. I mean, we've seen successes in tokenizing real estate investment. I have a client that has tokenized Chinese artifacts. Right. Nobody can go out and buy $100 million jade artifact, but you might want to have a little piece of it. Well, you can do that with tokens very easily.
Well, when you say you may have a little piece of it, you have a piece of it until it's no longer your piece, which, I'm going to go this direction. Every business, with almost no exceptions in history, starts out worth nothing and ends up worth nothing.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And it's the same with a token, right? It's going to start out worth nothing and it's going to end up worth nothing. The question is, when do you get in and when do you get out?
Well, and my point is that I would like to have the right to get in and get out if I want to. And that's right. What you
can. So when you say get out, the problem with getting out is the tokens have no underlying value, right? So if I have equity in a private company, even though in theory I can't sell it, in reality, in almost all circumstances, I can sell it to a properly qualified accredited investor.
Right.
And no matter what my agreement with the company is, either they buy it back for that amount or the other investor can buy it for that amount. And so SPVs are being created to turn that into a liquid market. And by the way, I have a substantial ownership in one of the companies that does that. So yay. but turning it into liquid is the key for these long-term investments. And the other thing is, however, you presumably have insider knowledge, right? As a private investor, you have a right to information that the public does not have. And so you can, if you sell some equity in that company, you have insider knowledge, but it's not covered by SEC regulation, right?
Well,
because it's a private company.
You're talking about, no, they are. They're subject, there's anti-fraud rules. I mean, I think what you're saying is that information is not publicly available like it would be for a public company, public statements. And that's very true. But that's where due diligence comes in. That's why the buyer should do their diligence and they should ask all the right questions and get all the right reps and warranties from the seller. I do a lot of secondary deals and my buyers, they're pretty darn careful about what they want to know. And my sellers are pretty darn careful saying, look, you've asked me every question you wanted to ask. And I've told you everything I know.
Yeah, those are the key issues, right? Knowing what to ask and telling the truth. And,
right.
And so what we see a lot of is not that.
Okay. Well, I don't have clients like that, so I don't see a lot of that, but I'm sorry you're having that experience.
Probably the reason you don't see much of that is because you're a good lawyer. And you say, you might want to look at this, something the other guys missed, right?
Yeah. I mean, but I have been, over the years approached by companies that had things that I just didn't believe. And by the way, that's with all my clients. I kind of have to believe it before they become a client. And not only believe that it's real, not just the egregious stuff, but also believe that they've got something that I think is going to be successful or has a chance at it. Let's give them a chance,
Yeah. So now, full disclosure, I'm one of your clients. So you must think that I'm credible for some reason. So I'm not sure whether that's an advertisement for me or for you.
Well, just be successful and it'll be an ad for both of us.
All right. So crypto has entered the conversation. So cryptocurrencies, blockchain distributed ledgers. Let's just break this out for a second. Cryptocurrencies is what everybody's talking about and what you're talking about with Roger. Blockchain or distributed ledgers are the technologies. And what a distributed ledger means is that
you know, everybody involved in something, you know, you and your business partners, you know, your, you know, whoever they are, have a copy of a ledger, just like the old fashioned ledger. And anytime anybody writes or erases anything in it, everybody with a copy sees that. Right. So you can base this trust on the idea that, you know, you're not going to be able to non-repudiation. You're not going to be able to assert something untrue or deny something true because everybody has a copy. Everybody sees it at the same time. And I'm very much on the fence on the whole cryptocurrency thing. Right? You know, as anybody who listens to this show knows, I'm a big fan of Terry Pratchett, and the book Making Money goes into this whole transition from a gold standard to a paper standard, and the wealth of the city, of the nation state in this case, you know, is the nation state itself. It's Ankh-Morpork. You know, what is the value of that as opposed to what's this value of this lump of metal? And cryptocurrencies, and you've touched on a lot of them, you know, there's a lot of, you know, ideological positioning with this. You know, maybe this is a new world order with a Ayn Rand based, you know, approach to monetization. Who knows? Right. I'm just sort of watching this to see how the whole socio-political side of it plays out. The technology is the technology. But yeah, is that backed by a fiat currency? Is it mature enough? Are there, we're talking, are there legal structures, financial structures that would make anybody actually want to do this, this scale and, you know, replace the greenback in 100 years? Who knows?
So I think there are some big differences out here, right? And the one you pointed out first, which is right, is distributed ledger is not cryptocurrency, right? So blockchain is a mathematical-based method for distributed ledger. And it has problems. It has performance problems. It has other problems. The idea of it is that it should be non-reputable. So what banks do today is they have databases, and distributed databases have non-repudiation. All that. What they do is they have transaction verification processes so that you can demonstrate that a transaction that was recorded in this location was also recorded in this many other locations, simultaneously correctly recorded. So if one of them fails, you have redundancy and backup. And you can add cryptographic checksums to those, which is something that I did for the forensics tool that I developed in the late 1990s for just automating forensic processes so you can verify that what you did is what's reflected in what you provided to the courts, right? So that's the addition of integrity through cryptographic checksums, which have, you know, started in the antivirus space in 1984. So the distributed ledger is just the next generation of that, and it's all fine and good with all of its trade-offs and problems. Just like the banks, if the bank should happen to, in 6 of the 8 copies, have somebody that goes and changes the value, then the other two will be disregarded because majority wins. And it's the same in the distributed ledger world. If you get control of enough of the components of the distributed ledger, you can make it be the way you want, regardless of what the reality was before. In the physical space, we were talking about this with Roger before. In the physical space, when we do this on paper with pens and so forth, then you get the question document examiner who comes in and puts their chemicals on it and puts their microscopes on it and waves their hands and does whatever their magic is and says, this is forged because the ink could not come from the contemporaneous kind, or it was a different pen, or the paper wasn't, whatever, right? In the digital space, because everything is not infinitesimal but finite, the inconsistency is how you detect those forgeries. Well, okay, distributed ledger by itself, again, if you have enough control of enough systems, you can cause it to go wrong, and my inconsistency analysis will maybe miss it if you get every copy everywhere and if you don't have records of everything else along the way. So that's what that game is all about. The other big problem in that space is that the vulnerabilities are almost never from the cryptography or the distributed ledger or the mathematics. It comes from the fact that somebody wrote a piece of software to control it, called a wallet, for example, and all the wallets have a back door in them, so you can just break into the wallets and take my money, and it looks like you, and you can't disclaim it because it came from your wallet.
Right.
So that's how you rip people off in that space. Break into the computers, you break into the endpoints, you break into the operating systems. That's how you defeat the system. In terms of all of society, the fundamental problem is not that fiat currency is somehow better than cryptocurrency or any other representation. The issue is that fiat currency is backed by the full faith and credit of the government that has the fiat currency. So if you have, you know, good old greenbacks, US dollars, it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, which, as long as it is the dominant nation state in the world, will continue to be the currency of record for the world. And if China becomes, you know, more powerful in that way for a sustained period of time, everybody will say that the yuan is it, right? And that's how that is. When you have real estate, you know, I have deeds to real estate. Yeah, if the nation state fails and the state decides to take over all the real estate, you lose. But on the other hand, you know, shy of that, the state will enforce your ownership of the real estate using the old stamps and pieces of paper and signatures associated with how real estate is recorded in the various recording offices. So the new technology doesn't really change anything about the underlying core of ownership and of the power of the government and the governance structure that overlays this. And that's what all of the technical stuff, all the cryptocurrency fails to address. And it's now being addressed by government, through governance, typically through the criminal system of throwing people in jail who ripped off a few $1 billion in cryptocurrency by lying. Okay. So it's, you know, it's not about the bits. It's back to what Roger is saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, the word that comes to mind, the cautionary word is utopian, right? If you think anything is going to suddenly overnight solve, you know, to make everybody honest and do all these wonderful things, you know, and herons will no longer eat frogs. That's probably not true. And, you know, I love distributed ledgers. I think it's a fantastic technology. I think it has great applications, you know, in the other word, you know, that comes to mind is monolithic, right? You know, so in the software supply chain security world right now, we're talking about SBOMs, the software bill of materials, and sometimes DBOM, the digital bill of materials attestation ecosystem. And there we can use blockchain and hyperledgers and, you know, distributed ledgers and so forth between various parties to reach a level of operation and access and non-repudiation that fits that case. But, you know, we're still at this transitionary stage where fewer and fewer, you know, quarter to quarter, this is actually getting much, much better, but, you know, fewer people are saying it, but it's like, where is the repository, you know, for all supply chain? There isn't one. Can't be one, can't ever one. Where is the blockchain? Where is the cryptocurrency? Where is no? That's not how any of this works, right? You know, distributed systems, you know, that in these sorts of things representing commitments and fulfillment of commitments, whether they're commercial, you know, whether financial or not. You know, I see fantastic applications for the technologies behind cryptocurrency because those parties know each other and they're working together now, and they can just be more efficient, and it can encourage honesty. Look, I believe in some of the utopian goals of all this technology, including, you know, distributed ledgers, over long periods of time, because it helps people who are honest be on an even playing field with people who are dishonest. Transparency is a great disinfectant. So, but no, it's not overthrowing all the world's governments and replacing money tomorrow or anything like that, or solving all the world's problems. It's just a really interesting phase transition.
And the thing about democracy is, guess what? Majority wins.
Right.
So if you can convince the majority or even the plurality, you win. So it's like, forget the rules. Well, please don't. But, you know, the rule is, you know, what is it? The golden rule? Who has the gold makes the rules. Right. And you can see that in Roger's discussion of getting crunched down, right?
Right.
You want my money, you're going to give up. But it turns out I'm in that situation right now with a company that I have, you know, equity in. And the founder is trying to get funds. He's finally gotten somebody to put in a bunch of funds. But the person that wants to put in the funds just wants to say, I want to be better than everybody else. So you get my money. I have preferences. And anybody else with preferences doesn't get them anymore. And my agreement says I get any preference anybody else gets. So I'm faced with the question of, should I help out this founder to succeed and give up some of my own value in the company, which, you know, my calculations say that value comes because, you know, I've lost money in a lot of other ones, but that's part of my statistics is to make money here. Right.
Right.
And, you know, it hurts to do this at the same time. I do want to help the company. Yeah. I have the agreement, and the lawyer on the other side says, oh, your agreement's not valid. And so, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay, well, in that case, we're done talking. And then the CEO gets back in touch and says, no, we can't be done talking because then I don't get the funds, right? So I don't want to leverage this against people. What I want is just to get, you know, my honest remuneration for the work and the time and the effort and everything else I put into this company in lieu of all the other companies that didn't get funded, even though I put in the same time and work and effort for whatever reason, some succeed, some fail. It's a tough thing. So I need to make my, you know, human to human decision and discussion with this guy this weekend. And I won't tell you how I'm leaning or why I'm leaning that way, but this is the reality of that world.
And it's the hacking, right? You know, life is hacking. You know, I honestly think we can take, you know, our hacking, you know, goes all the way back to early cellular life, right? You know, and it's, you know, and as I get older myself, you know, and as I watch, you know, civilization march along and develop and so forth, you know, you take it into the future, you know, say 1,000 years from now, we have automation everywhere, you know, medical issues, you know, the human biome is completely understood. Lifespans are indeterminate. What's left? Everything, right? You know, sail boats because, you know, get yourself in chaotic environments, you know, make relationships, personal relationships, business relationships, do things because you can't, from all of these perspectives, you know, we're talking, you know, digital and analog a bit ago. And I didn't put this in there, but it's like, yeah, digital doesn't really exist, right? I mean, it does. Yeah, that's, we do all sorts of things on it. But to be really clear, you know, you look at those waveforms, that's not an actual cube. a variable world.
When you say it doesn't exist, ideas exist. They're manifested in physical reality, unless you want to believe in some, you know, non-physical version of, you know, even if you believe in the, you know, whatever the ether has for you, presumably that's still physical. Or if it's on an ethereal plane, the ethereal plane is physical in the ether, right? That is, the ether is the definition. All right. But even if you say, great, there's a separate plane, nothing physical about it. In the digital world, within the constraints of temperature, pressure, so forth, it comes out digital, right? It's designed specifically so that you get to a definitive answer, one or zero for each bit. And if you don't get that answer, you get another mechanism that says, oh, there's an error. It's yeah. And here's the one or the zero that I've replaced it with, because I don't know what it was. Here's what it is. It's like that, right? So when you say it's all analog, of course, underneath it is. But every model, every structure we put in place, every way we think about everything ultimately comes down to there's a physical component and then there's decision making. And so you don't get to change your decision in the past. You get one way or the other, and the future goes forward. And when I get a time machine, I will correct that. But until then, it stands.
You know, I commented this in the social media post today. So when I am sailing the boats, I use an app called Strava. And Strava shows a map, and it shows a dot where you are, and it shows a line of every place you've been, you know, on that journey, you know, to that point. And I've developed a habit, you know, of just scrolling that dot to the top of the screen, rotating it so that the next of my path is from there down. And I do that over and over and over again as I'm sailing. And it's, I found it has a very real visceral benefit. You know, I physically feel better because I'm taking everything that's happened up to now, I'm moving it off the screen because it doesn't make any difference. You know, Thursday night, 1:30 in the morning, I'm in Fort Pierce Inlet. I've made all sorts of plans over about 8 hours. I've gotten to a certain point, and that path on this app, you know, draws that. And I get to that point, and I stop, and the line changes. And, you know, I'm literally, you know, at that point, out on the water, scrolling it up. My dot's right here. I'm looking at this. The situations are not going to allow me to continue my intent. I need to make new decisions. And everything that's happened up to that point doesn't matter. Because we'll put up and sit there and go, no, but I got it because I did all these things. It's like, look, yeah, you did. You don't have to. You know, it's, I mean, it's, you know, living the moment, right? And to the point of we're discussing here, it's like each decision, whether it's cryptocurrency or your legal things, at the end of the day, you know, everything else you've done before every moment, you know, is lovely. It's good to know about it, but you can't keep going back there. You'll never go anyplace else. You're here now, right? What do you do? That's the spice of life. That's what it's all about. And so, sometimes make really bad choices when a boat sinks.
I say that because last night my dinner had a particular spice in it, and I think it remains with me. But that's a separate issue for another day.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Tuesday, October 10th at 9 a.m., go to Angel. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co. And next week on The Cyber Show, Pathfinder finds a path for OT, or does she? Another psycho discussion begins. Mark makes billions of value in hardware for everyone else. Joe gets wise to being a control freak once he measures. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.